Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting what you say. Today is the day. Good morning, friends, and welcome to Faith Radio Mornings here on the 10th of January. I am your host for the show, Dr. Peter Kapsner. Delighted to be on the show with you, listening from around the Midwest, from around the East Coast, from all through the country, whether it's live through terrestrial radio or through the app that you're streaming and have downloaded the Faith Radio app to listen to the program. Joined in studio, of course, by Rachel Sutton and Paul Perot, good friends of the show, do such a great job of producing it each day, bringing news and guests from around our country to talk about the news from a distinctly Christian perspective, with honest conversations, with a genuine faith and a real hope. We're not going to get too caught up in the political divides or the conservative liberal debates. We're going to try to keep our eyes fixed on Jesus together and talk about the news from a balanced perspective, and again, from the perspective of the kingdom. And we've got a big first hour ahead here on Faith Radio Mornings. We're going to be joined by our friend Ben Johnson of the Acton Institute, who joins us every Thursday morning to talk about so many of the different headlines in our country. And we have a special Thursday morning guest in the second half of this hour, and that's Carmen LeBurge of Connecting Faith. She normally joins me on Friday mornings, but she is off on Friday, and so she's going to come in the second half of this hour to continue all of these conversations. Should be a great first hour ahead to talk through the items of the day. And as we get started this morning, we have some quotes here from one of my favorite theologians, Jürgen Moltmann, who writes often about a theology of hope. And this morning, as we reflect on some of his writings, he's talking about the importance of the resurrection. And I think about Paul's words when he says, if the resurrection hadn't happened, our faith would be in vain. But because it has happened, we do have a hope in the future. And Moltmann says this, that faith sees in the resurrection of Jesus not just the eternity of heaven, but the future of the very earth on which his cross stands. It sees in Jesus the future of the very humanity for which he died. That is why it finds in the cross the hope of the earth. So believing in Christ's resurrection does not mean affirming a fact. It means being possessed by the life-giving Spirit and participating in the powers of the age to come. And that is why we are here on Faith Radio Mornings, part of this beautiful and big story from the eternal kingdom of God. Ben Johnson of the Acton Institute up next as we get started with the news items of the day. Welcome to Faith Radio Mornings.
My right, a right given by God, to live a free life, to live in freedom.
It is 8 minutes past the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings, and we are joined at this time by our friend Ben Johnson of the Acton Institute, the Reverend Ben Johnson, the journalist Ben Johnson. It is the Ben Johnson this morning. Good morning, my friend.
Good morning to you.
It's great to have you on the program, as always, Ben. I know there's a lot of news items that we can get into, but maybe primary among them has to do with the fact that the president walked out of a meeting pretty quickly with the Democrats yesterday as they were looking to maybe make some progress on the impasse of the wall, but doesn't look like anything was happening along those lines. So, Ben, your choices this morning are to try to deal with the impasse of the wall or maybe heal the Protestant Reformation or go back and bring some reconciliation to the great schism of the church. What do you pick?
I think Great Schism would probably be more doable than this particular impasse. I mean, the reality of it is that, the Democratic Party has said that any funding for the wall is immoral, and it's difficult to see how you're going to back down from a stance that you've said violates morality, and done so publicly as Chuck and Nancy did in their response to the Oval Office address this past week. So Donald Trump has said he has no trouble with this shutdown going on potentially indefinitely. He's used the term years. It would be difficult to see it going that way. I think that's probably his well-worn stratagem of setting down the most extreme marker to begin with and then gradually moving back, as we've seen him do throughout this process. But He's still demanding more than $5 billion for this wall, and Chuck and Nancy have said even $1 would probably be too much. So it's difficult to see how this impasse is going to come about. There was a meeting yesterday, supposed to be the meeting to solve all of the issues, and according to Chuck Schumer, the president pounded the table and walked out. According to Vice President Pence, he handed out candy to everyone, but whether he was the candy man or the pounding man, nothing got done. That's the bottom line.
Well, and in terms of moving forward, again, it's pretty hard to see what's going to resolve this impasse. The president certainly, if he backs down at this point, risks the 2020 election cycle for himself, as this was the primary promise that certainly was chanted throughout those campaign events, build that wall and build that wall. And on the Democratic side of it, they were just swept into power in the House of Representatives. And so there's not a lot of backing down that's probably going to happen there either.
No, and both sides use this to their own political advantage. You know, of course, the optics of having a government shutdown typically favor the Democratic Party and are against whatever Republican is on the other side of that. Interestingly, that's whether the Republican is the president or the Congress, as was the case 20 years ago. But it always seems to favor the Democrats. On the other hand, President Trump can say very simply that the Democrats are favoring government workers and a small segment of the population. On the other hand, I'm favoring border security against terrorism that protects every American. And so it helps him politically to have this go on. But ultimately, he has to find some way to at least begin building the wall during his first term, or he will not have a second.
Well, and certainly there's going to be probably some more pressure by this time next week, because the people are going to start missing some paychecks as soon as tomorrow morning. And boy, as soon as the money stops flowing in for some of the federal workers, and that's going to be a very difficult and discouraging situation, it's going to be interesting to see where the heat goes next week.
It is. You're right. Tomorrow is the first paycheck that they would miss, so there's some pressure to get things moving before then. I don't think the Democrats will begin to take a backward step, no matter what is offered to them before that point, just so that there is a little bit of pain and the president can be blamed for it, politically speaking. But I think that other than that particular date that we keep in mind, the fact is this could go on for a very long time. Ultimately, all the federal workers always get their back pay. But in the meantime, there's a lot of pain for people who are simply caught in the crossfire of two parties that refuse to act like adults and get along.
Yeah, it really does have an impact on the average daily life of people in our country. We've entrusted people to lead and to work together on that, but now regular people are having their income impacted. So it's going to be interesting to see by this time when you and I are chatting again next week, Ben. And, of course, there's lots more in the news as well. It seems like everywhere I go, whether it's the evening news on NBC, whether it's a Twitter feed, whether it's something on CNN or Fox News or any place like that, I am seeing AOC. What is AOC here, Ben? Who is this person and what's all happening with her?
AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She is the future of the Democratic Party, according to the chairman, Tom Perez. And, of course, she is she's the youngest person to be elected to Congress, 29 years old, former bartender from the Bronx, and upset an incumbent Democrat, Joe Crowley. So this was very much a surprise to a lot of people, but she's a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, and she's put forward a Green New Deal. And this Green New Deal has an estimated price tag, fairly conservative, of $49 trillion. How she plans to raise this, she did not elaborate when she was asked on 60 Minutes, nor when Jake Tapper asked her, nor when any other individual has asked her, how do you plan to pay for this? She simply says you just pay for it. But it's a $49 trillion price tag. The whole U.S. GDP is $19 trillion. So it's difficult to see, even if you confiscated every dollar for more than 2 years in a row, you wouldn't be able to pay for the new spending, let alone all of the existing spending, everything else, defense, Social Security, every other dollar, even if you dedicated everything just to this one program. And that's the programs that are already spelled out. She talks about ending all fossil fuel energy within the next 10 years, which is quite candidly impossible under any way that we know. There are ways that we could switch to solar and wind. However, they have certain disadvantages. For example, sometimes it's dark and not windy. So it's difficult to use those particular kinds of energy. There's no way to store it as of yet. Just creating the storage capacity would cost $2 trillion. And then there's this little elastic clause in the draft legislation. And it says that this will, quote, include additional measures such as a basic income programs, universal health care programs, and any others as the select committee may deem appropriate. So not only would we be talking about things that deal with the environment, but things like establishing a universal basic income. The government would guarantee every American a job at, quote, a living wage, so presumably at least $15 an hour, and universal health care, Medicare for all, which has a price tag of an additional $32 trillion. So you have this expansive government agenda all crammed within the stratagem of saving the earth within 10 years. It looks very much like socialism wearing a green mask.
Yeah, and from an ideological perspective, the climate change environment conversation, it does seem that she certainly is on the winning political side of this given the future. When I'm with the next generation so often at university, Ben, there is a lot more conversation about environment and taking care of our earth than maybe I would have guessed if I had just been sort of watching news cycles. So how do we balance the sort of the future where we do need to maybe have this conversation as a country given where the next generation is headed with also the idea that you can't just find $49 trillion in the couch cushions?
I think there are two issues that we face. First of all, you're right that this is the defining issue for many young people across the world of all backgrounds, faithful people, atheists, people with no background, but a lot of very faithful Christians believe this is a defining issue for them. And first of all, I think that we need to look at the actual impact and the human impact, what difference this is likely to make if we were to change everything that she is calling for. Would it actually make a difference? And the fact of the matter is the United States doesn't release nearly as much, for example, as China does in terms of CO2 emissions. So even if we went to a zero carbon economy, it's not clear that it would make a difference because by definition, global warming is affected by the entire globe. And unless the entire world does this, including economies that have said they have no interest in doing so, then it's not clear that we're going to make a huge difference. That's number one. The other aspect is simply to communicate to young people that there's a great deal of alarmism that is being spread in this movement. If you want to waste a good 2 hours of your life, and what college kid doesn't, have them watch Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth and go through all of the predictions that were made that would have happened within the next 10 years and then realize that film's more than 10 years old. The ice caps have not melted. The world has not come to an end. Polar bears are not drowning by the millions. It's alarmism because scientists have found, psychologists understand, if you are in a mania and you believe this is a defining issue and that we have no time to decide, then you're likely to make a snap decision without doing the proper analysis. It works on showroom floors. It works when someone's trying to sell you a car or a home, and it works when they're trying to sell you socialism under a green guise.
Well, and certainly, is there a possibility that we could at least find some middle ground with this? Because as you have referenced, there's a lot of alarmism and maybe a lot of poo-pooing on either side of it as the pendulum swings back and forth. But I think back to the time, Ben, when it was pretty clear some of the human impact on the ozone layer when I was growing up, and we saw this growing hole. And there was a pretty significant one-to-one relationship between some of these CFCs and the ozone hole, and we were able to fix that. And it seemed balanced, and it seemed like a reasonable suggestion. Is there any way to at least that politicians could ever come to a place of saying, let's just have a grown-up conversation about this and stop all the alarmism?
Politicians, absolutely not. Again, easier to heal the Great Schism, easier to heal the Protestant Reformation than have politicians speak in a way that is grown up and respectful to our intellect. However, I think that we can, and I think that's really the challenge for each of us to speak in a way that is respectful, but that is balanced, and for each of us to essentially do our own research, bring that research to one another, and say, we've seen this claim made, however, it would appear that in reality, and then find the basics for ourselves in conversations in faith communities, in networks like this, where we can get down to brass tacks about exactly what needs to be done, and from the ground up, we can present our own agenda to Congress rather than vice versa.
Great insights, as always, from our friend Ben Johnson of the Acton Institute. Ben, when we come back from a short break here, we'd love to change the topic towards health care and how people are going to be paying for things moving forward. I know the Democratic platform very much is for a single-payer Medicaid-for-all program, and we've seen even a small snippet of that in New York City, not necessarily working terribly well. So I want to get your insight on that next year on Faith Radio Mornings. about 21 minutes after the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings, and Rachel Sutton's coming with some new music in the program. I like that one, Rachel. Solid choice. Ben, are you specifically a Christian music guy? Will you listen to any kind of music?
I love all kinds of music, but I was a DJ in Christian music for years upon years, so I love the that genre.
It is really fun. It's fun to watch how it shifts and changes, and even some of the songs are really reflective of where we are as a culture, where we are as a church at any given moment.
Yeah, you know, you got to see, you're right, the dynamic change from, say, a Michael W. Smith or a Carmen, going back to my early days all the way up through Mercy Me and Casting Crowns and people like we have today. So it's phenomenal, but I think it's very high quality and it's ministering to a lot of people's souls, so it's incredibly important.
It is really fun. I know we were all things Amy Grant when I was growing up. All the old cassette tapes right there, we wore those babies out. It was fun. Well, fun to chat with you here again on a Thursday morning like this about the news, and certainly Obamacare and all of the hand-wringing that we went through as a country related to that has not fully resolved the health care debate in our country, and it seems to be coming up to the surface yet again. What do we see sort of as a country? What do we see happening in New York City, Ben?
Well, in New York City, Mayor Bill de Blasio has just announced that he's going to institute a new program to give health care to everyone who is resident in the city. So if you say you live in New York City, you will have what's called NYC Care. Now, there are 600,000 uninsured in the Big Apple. About 300,000 of those are illegal immigrants. This would cover all of them, and it says that people will pay on a sliding scale based on what they make. So this is largely going to be a government-funded program. Now, I think there are a couple of problems with this right off the bat. First of all, people already have access to health care. Someone who's in the healthcare industry cannot turn somebody away, regardless of immigration status or any other reason. They have to care for everyone who comes before them. That's part of the Hippocratic Oath, part of the what it means to be involved in a healing ministry. But one of the problems is that Bill de Blasio wants this program to cut down on using the emergency room, which is the most expensive part of the entire healthcare delivery industry. The ER costs the most. Now, there's a problem. The studies have shown that this doesn't reduce ER use. There was a study in the New England Journal of Medicine about 2 years ago conducted by a Harvard professor named Catherine Baker that found that actually if you give people Medicaid coverage, it increases the use of emergency rooms by 40%. So you're going to have additional usage of the emergency room, the most expensive part. Also, they found that giving people Medicaid coverage makes them feel better. It makes them feel happier, but it doesn't actually make them any healthier physically. It didn't improve their health, according to the New England Journal of Medicine study conducted by a Harvard professor. Second of all, it drastically underestimates the cost. Bill de Blasio allowed about the cost of one doctor visit per uninsured person, $170 a person. There's already a pilot program to insure people in his city, and it costs 27 times as much as he has allotted. He's allotted $100 million. You're talking about probably more like $2.7 billion a year. And that's just for the uninsured that they already have. The big problem with this is if you advertise that anyone who is in the Big Apple, whether a resident or not a resident, legal or illegal, gets free health care, you're going to turn the Big Apple into the biggest magnet for healthcare tourism in the world. Every sick person in the world will show up there and get free healthcare at the cost of New York City taxpayers. So I think that's the biggest problem with this, is that there is simply, it's a bottomless hole that anyone in the world who can get to New York City will be able to exploit.
Well, and certainly, Ben, when you talk about the cost related to both of these issues from the Green New Deal that was proposed by Cortez or some of what's happening with health care, I think it's very helpful to be mindful that the programs themselves are important. But I don't know of too many situations in which people manage to underestimate the cost of these programs. It's kind of like building a house. You start with a certain figure, and the next thing you know, you're almost double than that. And that seems to be the case in all of these programs, to be mindful that whatever is the upfront projection is probably going to be exceeded by quite a bit.
Inevitably, they always underestimate, they always overpromise and underestimate the cost, and that's true whether it's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez Green New Deal or whether you're talking about New York City Care or whatever the government program tends to be. The one thing that's really important in all of this is not so much the program as it is that we actually provide high quality health care. And it's not clear to me how you're going to add 600,000 new people to the system without adding any new doctors or nurses or any other personnel and not have it collapse the system, end up with a sort of a winter emergency like they do every year with the NHS, where they have a limited number of doctors, possibly decreasing due to Brexit, according to some estimates. And nonetheless, you're going to have increased care as a society that is aging. In New York City, you're adding a great deal of population because it is a population magnet. And now you're adding 600,000 new uninsured people minimum, as well as anyone who comes, who is drawn there through healthcare tourism, without adding any new person to that. You're simply going to increase wait times and have people get sicker before they finally see a doctor.
Well, as always, Ben, I certainly appreciate your insights into so many of these different topics. You just are able to speak to a wide range of issues from a Christian standpoint. So thanks for the work you do behind the scenes and the research. Thanks for what you're doing for Acton Institute and all of the writing and research that's part of your weekly routine. So have a great rest of this week and weekend, Ben. I look forward to chatting again next week.
It's always my pleasure. Thank you, and God bless.
We'll head over to some Lighten Up. I do a little laughing this morning with Ken Davis, as well as some bottom-of-the-hour news. And when we come back for the second half of this hour, I'll be joined by our normal Friday morning guest, Carmen LeBurge, joining us for a special edition on a Thursday morning here on Faith Radio Mornings. Pretty interesting news coming out of Bismarck, North Dakota this morning, where we see that lawmakers in North Dakota want to add a Bible course as an elective. It's a bill that would allow schools to offer Bible history courses, non-compulsory, but students could sign up for it on an elective basis. The North Dakota American Civil Liberties Union says the course would focus too much on Christianity to the exclusion of other beliefs. But it seems to me that offering a history course and just looking at it through that lens is not that different than studying Middle Eastern history, in which you might look at Islam and the historical nature of that as well. So it's going to be really interesting to see the developments coming out of North Dakota with this issue in the future. Well, up next, Carmen LeBurge of Connecting Faith, and we're going to talk a little bit about an increasing embrace of abortion in our country and what that looks like moving forward for the next generation. Bill English joined us yesterday on Faith Radio Mornings. He's from BibleandBusiness.com, and he gave us a pretty clear and concise summary of how to go about letting an employee go.
Just 2-3 minutes. That's okay. All I do. And I usually have my HR director there, and I don't do it in her office. I do it in mine. The phraseology that I use is, look, this isn't working out, so I'm going to ask you to find work elsewhere. Today's your last day. I'll need you to turn in your key and time card and stuff like that. We'll ship your personal effects to you from your cube. And I'm sorry that this didn't work out. If it is for cause, I will tell them this is why. Of course, by the time that I'm saying that, they're not hearing it because their heads are not in that meeting anymore. But I'll go ahead and say that anyways. And then I turn the whole thing over to the HR director for all the paper signing and all the housekeeping work. And that's what they do. I do not go back into the past and rehash what has happened. I do not talk about who said what or he said, she said stuff. Don't do any of that. I've made my decision. Your employment is over. I'm sorry, but I'm going to move on without you, and we need you to exit the business.
Bill had a number of very helpful tips for letting somebody go from a Christian standpoint as a Christian employer, and it was just one of those things that we don't really think about much, but how do we really do this well from a Christian standpoint? So if you want to catch the entire segment, head to myfaithradio.com and search for Bill English. You'll undoubtedly see that and other topics that Bill has addressed during his time on the morning show this morning. So with that, we've got Carmen LeBurge up next on the show. Looking forward to chatting with her. We're going to talk a little bit about this hashtag #ShoutMyAbortion movement that's happening in our country, as well as why the decline in religious practice is bad news for disaster recovery.
The truth is, we've institutionalized illness and death so that we don't have to live in reality. This is Jim Garlow. We've underestimated the demonic nature of the cult of death. It has desensitized us to the evil that lurks within our nation. If we were people truly walking in righteousness, there would be more of an uprising against the wickedness that wants people dead rather than alive, whether that be the preborn or the sick and the elderly. Will the law protect those who cannot protect themselves? Once the mindset is accepted that someone has the authority to decide whether it's better for another person to die or not, involuntary euthanasia is the result. Despite the reasons and excuses, as Christians, we know every single life is valuable. God is sovereign over all. and he determines the moment of life and death. Be well-versed on this issue at jimgarlow.com.
Well, that music normally represents the first segment of a Friday morning, but we're in a second segment of a Thursday morning, and that does mean Carmen LaBurge of Connecting Faith, the Midday Show program here on Faith Radio Network, is joining us to help me think through some of the news items of the day as well. Good morning, Carmen.
Hey, good morning, Peter.
So are you
early?
Yeah, are you off tomorrow morning, or why are we doing this today?
Because for the next couple of days, I'm going to be at the Women in Apologetics Conference at Biola. And so I'm going to be on an airplane when you and I normally talk on Friday morning.
I love it. So tell me a bit more about the Women in Apologetics Conference. Is there something distinctly female about this subject that you're engaging with over the weekend?
I'm not sure that the subject matter is distinctly female. I think that all of the folks who will be there are probably going to be women. Certainly all of the speakers are women. And part of this, Peter, is how does the female voice speak into this arena of apologetics in a way that might be less propositional maybe than men do, more conversational, which of course is right up my alley because conversational apologetics is sort of my wheelhouse. So how do we do this in a way that is maybe more dialogue than monologue? How do we do it in a way that is open to conversations with our kids and our family? There's a huge emphasis on children at this conference, and there's like mama bear apologists. There's all kinds of women out there doing this stuff. There's like I'm excited to meet them, and I'm going to bring back lots of conversations from the Women in Apologetics Conference to Connecting Faith next week.
No, I can't wait to hear what you learn about that, Carmen. And you make such a good point that propositional apologetics, or the idea that we're arguing truth statements, it's not unimportant, but it does tend to take the relationship out of play. And that's been, of course, one of the critiques of the church over the last 20 to 30 years, is just sort of standing in a pulpit and being right about something. And we're talking about maybe a pendulum swing that relationships really matter here.
Well, and I think it's a both and.
None
of these women are in any way saying that the men who are engaged in apologetics, that's sort of where most of us learned what we now know. And so the propositional apologetics is back there. It's in the background. It's the foundation of the conversations that we're having. But it is in the relationships where we find the opportunities for the conversation. And so I think that it will be very interesting to see how these women approach the same topics that you would see at any apologetics conference, but they'll be approaching them, I think, from a distinctively female view of things and relational perspective. So I think people can actually stream it online, the Women in Apologetics Conference, if they just Google it.
Yeah, I'll definitely check that out a bit this weekend, and looking forward to debriefing with you next Friday on what you learned from that conference. And, of course, getting into some of the news and topics of the day, I see that you sent me a note about hashtag ShoutMyAbortion and some of the YouTube videos. Carmen, tell our listeners about what's going on here.
So ShoutYourAbortion is actually this kind of decentralized network of people who talk about abortion as an experience in their own lives and then encourage other people to do it. And so I would describe it in the broadest sense of the term of what those of us who are evangelists think we do every day. These people, they believe that they have the good news of abortion, and they are out there touting it in a way that is nothing short of they describe it as gospel. They describe it as, they use theological language, and they are now using not only social media, but they are using the power of social media that's directed at children via a YouTube channel that is designed for kids to really manipulate children on this particular issue.
And in terms of with what the impact of that is moving generationally, it seemed to me, Carmen, that we've seen it sort of a little bit of a momentum shift, especially with science revealing viability questions of the womb is now going back to maybe 16 weeks, 20 weeks. And of course, it keeps pushing back from there. Does this represent any possibility of a momentum shift the other direction?
Well, sure. You and I both know that we seem to be moving out of, hey, here's the rational evidence that you are male or female. Here's the rational evidence. Here's the biological evidence of something that's true. And instead, all kinds of conversations are centered around how you feel and what you believe and what you want. It's become the concept of a selfie culture, is true in this arena as well. And so I think that promoting this kind of material to children, you and I both know, I mean, if you get them when they're young, if you can indoctrinate them into your way of thinking when they're young, you have them when they grow up. They're going to be more willing to defend the ideas that they adopted as children than ideas that come to them later in life. And so I think it's tremendously manipulative. It is anti-science. It is anti-faith. And it's blatantly lying to kids and manipulating them.
In terms of getting our kids early like that, like you said, Carmen, I know that one of the other topics I wanted to chat with you about is the idea of the decline in religious practice, bad news for disaster recovery. We're talking about this isn't just maybe a 1 or 3 year phenomenon, but we've gone through some generations now, Carmen, in which people don't necessarily go to church as often as they used to. Maybe it's a Wednesday night or a Saturday or a Sunday, that activities for our families, whether it's soccer or band or something like that, seem to be dominating the week. We're moving at faster paces, all of those things. And now we're seeing maybe some of the rippling impact of that. I know that there's fewer and fewer kids getting involved in Christian ministries. I know we had Greg Yao from InterVarsity Christian Fellowship this week talking about the decline in attendance in Urbana. And now we're seeing that maybe there's going to be impact in terms of the church's role and faith's role in disaster recovery.
So I think this will be an interesting trend to watch. Our friend Jamie Ayton at the Wheaton Institute up there, the Disaster Institute. He's really the one that sort of brought this to my attention, and he's actually going to come and talk on Connecting Faith about this first of next week. But I think that when we look at who is participating in organized religion and then how those organized institutions mobilize for disaster recovery and relief, that's actually what we're talking about. Peter, I guess I'm holding out hope that that even people who are not people of faith and people who are not engaged in organized religion in terms of institutional religious organizations, I guess I'm hoping that maybe what we'll see is the emergence of a new way of people in a very decentralized economy and a decentralized network in terms of social media, how they might figure out how to mobilize and get the same things done out of a basic humanitarian motivation. Now, as a Christian, I would love, obviously, to see this trend reversed, but I'm also a hopeful person in terms of just because a person is lacking in a particular faith does not mean that they're lacking in the motivation to help another person. And so the basic sort of humanistic drive to help other people, which you and I both know is based on the internal reality that we recognize that that person is precious and an eternal being, even if we're not expressing it that way. So I guess I'm still holding out hope that that we'll still see great generosity among the American people, even in emerging generations, even if it's not through what you and I have experienced as organized institutional religion.
Yeah, and as students of history, we can see that there's a pretty common pattern where we move sort of if there's a decline that happens. And I know a lot of people are concerned about the decline of religious influence in our country. But if a decline happens, there always is followed by some kind of renewal. It's just the cycle that seems to be part and parcel to the human experience.
Sure. And I think that where the opportunity for the church really might be unmasked here is that these church-based institutionally church-based disaster relief and recovery efforts and programs, they are comprehensive. I mean, they are so comprehensive, Peter, it is mind-boggling. I mean, it's not just emergency water and shelter. It is long-term spiritual support. It is the recovery of local churches in those communities in order that then the church might get back on her feet, in order that the local church might be the place out of which the healing really comes for the community. Those are obviously not things that secularists or humanists are going to be interested in, and they don't have that kind of long-term commitment to stick with something. And so although I think that it's possible that we might see some kind of social organization of humanitarian disaster relief after these horrible big events happen in our nation and around the world, what we will not see grow out of that is the long-term spiritual recovery. And that will be, I believe, Peter, that will be the unique opportunity for the church to sort of reestablish that's her mission. That's really where she's great. That's really where she has something that nobody else has. So where sometimes people point to Christian relief efforts and they say, that's so that's just so basically humanitarian. Like, what are you doing that the United Way is not doing? What are you doing that some secular organization isn't doing? And they can say, well, we are also doing this, you know, this spiritual recovery. We're sending in chaplains and so on. But I think that increasingly what we will see is the church will need to emphasize those things as the thing that she's doing in disaster recovery.
That's the voice of our good friend, Carmen LeBurge, who joins us regularly on Faith Radio Mornings to talk through so many of these topics of the day from a Christian standpoint. And Carmen, when we come back in just a minute, I want to change the topic over to some news I read at the bottom of this hour, which is the fact that in North Dakota, there are some state legislators that are putting together a bill that would allow schools to offer Bible history courses. Would love your take on that next on Faith Radio Mornings. Radio Mornings. We are chatting with Carmen LeBurge about some of the topics of the day. And Carmen, Paul Perot put on my desk this morning some news items coming out of North Dakota in which some of the state legislatures are proposing a bill that would allow for students, at least on an elective basis, to take a Bible history course. And of course, as you would imagine, there's a lot of consternation that this is too much Christianity in schools. But we are teaching other religions from a historical standpoint. Is that not maybe the basis for what this bill is entailing?
So the idea that if you were to offer an elective course in which the most influential book in all of human history would be the core subject matter, to suggest that that is expressly evangelical, that gives a lot of credit to the Bible. Because basically what the people who are raising alarms about this are saying is, if kids read the Bible, they're going to find out some stuff we don't want them to know. It is you and I both know that reading the Bible is in and of itself a powerful experience and will lead you to truth. And what the people who are fighting against this don't want is for our kids to have access to the truth. So they want to keep the Bible in any form, in any expression, in any context, even if it is in the context of a historical course that's an elective that kids can only sign up for if they want to. In many cases, these are not even courses that are held on campus. I mean, so here, just for some perspective, I think people need to know that there are 41 states in the union that already have Bible curriculum offered in their schools. There's more than 3,000 high schools across the United States where Bible curriculum, public high schools, where a Bible curriculum of some kind is being offered. I mean, nearly a million students in the United States of America in public schools have already taken just one Bible curriculum that I'm aware of, which comes from the National Council on Bible Curriculum in Public Schools. And there are other curriculums as well. I mean, there's one curriculum that just is now totally online. So school districts don't even have to they don't have to purchase books. Kids don't have to have the, you know, experience the quote unquote relative shame of walking around with their Bible curriculum book. It's literally now an electronic version of the curriculum designed specifically for public schools. So I think that if folks want to, you know, they just, all you have to do is like Google Bible in public schools or Bible literacy or anything like that. And you're going to see that all across the United States of America, the Bible is used as a teaching curriculum. To teach the history of the world, to teach the history of this country, to teach the history of morality. It's used as a philosophy textbook. So I think that what Christians need to recognize is that we actually want people reading the Bible, even if the curriculum attached to it is not expressly evangelistic. And here, I mean, Peter, I might point to the Museum of the Bible in D.C. You know, the Green family is really clear. It is designed to be an expression of how the Bible has impacted human history as the most important book in all of human history, regardless of your faith perspective. You should know what's in there if you want to understand what's going on around you.
Well, in the Bible, too, Carmen, we were talking earlier, you and I, about the fact you're going to a conference this weekend about women and apologetics, and the Bible has an apologetical reality associated with it. There's so many people that when they just open the text, there's a God-breathed dimension that really begins to convict and enlighten the human heart. And so this really is, I would argue, sort of an opportunity for the school to bring the Bible, but also, more importantly, to lead people to faith.
Absolutely. One of the things we did over Christmas break as a family was we journeyed up to the Ark Encounter in, it's either Williamstown or Williamsport, Kentucky. I can't ever remember how the name of that town ends. But let me just tell you, that's just a giant gospel tract. That's all that is. And all they have done is revealed what Scripture says about the Ark of Noah and that time period and the time period leading up to it and the reality of life and into which God was speaking with wrath at that point in time. And then there's this whole section, Peter, where they describe all of the other flood narratives that are recorded all around the world in so many different religious heritages. Like, there are lots of testimonies around the globe to the fact that there was a flood. And one of the things that you experience at the Ark Encounter is you get to set the story that's in the Bible about the flood over and against all these other flood narratives, specifically related to the actual physical ship that supposedly preserved the lives of those who then sort of restarted the whole thing. Well, you know, the Ark's actually the only one that physically could have survived. So I just think that, you know, when we set the Bible in its historical context and we open it up, we see truth. We understand reality for what it is. And so those who are trying to keep it out of schools, even as a history book, are doing so for a particular reason. They don't want people reading the Bible.
Well, Carmen, we have to run here just a minute, but it sounds like on my next trip down to Disney World, when we drive from Minnesota to Florida, that I should take a diversion to go check out this Ark.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. No, if your kids are of reading age, so I would say third grade and up, anybody under that, you have to work too hard as a parent. Because there's so much reading, right? So, but it is unbelievable. It's jaw-dropping. It's absolutely jaw-dropping, the Ark Encounter.
Oh, I love it.
It's by our friends at Answers in Genesis,
okay,
if people want to know where to find it.
I'm super game. I'd love to check it all out, Carmen. Thanks for joining us on this Thursday, and really looking forward to hearing what you learn at the conference this weekend.
Thanks, Peter. Have a great weekend.
We'll take a short break here, and when we come back, we'll wrap up this first hour of the show, and we'll preview what's coming up in Hour 2 on Faith Radio Mornings. Always so great to chat with Carmen LaBurge of Connecting Faith. She can riff on just about anything that I throw her direction from a Christian standpoint. Well, up next here in Hour 2, I'll be joined by Professor Jim Bilby, a professor of Christian theology, and we will do our Ask Anything segment, and we'll wonder about what God means when he says that he's numbered our days.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.